From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 597, Subsea Data Centers with guest Ben Cutler, recorded Tuesday, July 3rd, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Got a special show for us today. I'm bringing on Ben Cutler, who's a member of the Special Projects team within Microsoft Research, which conducts project-based research focused on big challenges facing corporate business units. He currently manages Project Natick, researching undersea data centers, and Project Peabody, which is developing a holoportation system for automotive, retail, and other applications. Ben's career is focused on taking innovative ideas from conception to market introduction. Prior to his work at Microsoft, he was a principal at a number of technology startups and worked on the innovative information systems at DARPA, which is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Defense. Welcome, sir.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Project Natick, which is clearly our topic today, although I'm just going to call this undersea data centers. I think that's a great term. Is it actually named for the town in Connecticut?
No, it's actually just a code name. Although we heard in the past from people in Natick asking us why we named it after them, and
right,
we did not. I've also heard from other nearby towns in Massachusetts asking if we'll name our next project after them.
Well, and I make another show called .NET Rocks, which we've been doing since 2002. It predates the word podcasting. And my buddy, Carl Franklin, is his home is New London, Connecticut, right beside Groton, where the electric boat company, like right in that area. So I've been all over that area hanging with him. So the name seemed very familiar with him. So, but just a random code name that happened to line up with a Northeast New England town.
That's all it is. Although a wonderful area. Earlier in my career, I spent a fair amount of time in New England.
Lovely. I remember the original prototype of the Project Natick. Was it San Francisco Bay that you were doing the experiments in?
No, we were actually near Avila Beach in California.
Okay.
So kind of north of Santa Barbara.
Yeah, which is, that's good ocean country there. As a guy who lives by the sea, you know, I'm home in Vancouver and so forth, the ocean is a remarkably destructive thing, not conducive to electronics.
Very true. And yet, we've been putting things in the ocean for a very long time and doing it successfully.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, when we look to the ocean, there are places you don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
One place you don't want to be is on the surface because you're fully exposed to Mother Nature and all of the incredible power.
Right. It's kind of the worst of all worlds.
It really is. But what you find is, so there's the surface, so if you will, that interface between air and water is not a good place.
Mm-hmm.
And the second interface that's not good is between the water and land.
Right.
And so you kind of see this in any big storm when, for example, airplanes go far inland and all the ships go out to sea. Nobody wants to be right at that interface. It's not a good place to be during a big storm. But what you find is if that you are a reasonable distance offshore and you're on the seabed, you are largely immune to these different very destructive forces that happen.
Should we talk about the why? Why in the world would you want to do this? What advantage does it give you to put a data center?
So when we first started this project in 2014, one of our goals was how do we deploy more rapidly to customers?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the way data centers are basically constructed today, they are in fact construction projects. So it's much like building a house or an office building.
Right.
And so I have to find some land and you know, what the rules are, where I go, what the climate is, what the terrain is like, all of these things are variable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you spend some time looking at the ocean, what you find is that there's much more commonality in the ocean as you look around the planet than there is the land.
Right.
And so the idea here is we move from this idea of construction, which requires I need to bring everything I need to that location to create this data center there and then maintain it over its operational life, to something instead that's more like the phone in your pocket, which is it's manufactured in one of a handful of global factories, which is where all that knowledge base and supply chain has to be. And then we drop it in the water wherever we need it. So we can kind of move from this idea of building data centers, which can take a couple years, to something that our mantra early on was basically deployment anywhere in the world at scale within 90 days from decision to power on.
Nice. I mean, you literally could have all these things pre-built sitting in their containers and ready to be deployed. It's just a question of, what do you need to feed it from shore? Connectivity and power?
Yeah. So when we look at that, today, if you're going to do it, in most places, you'd end up with a cable or cables to shore that would do power and they'd do data. And certainly, if you look at Microsoft or any of our large peer competitors today, we all are well-versed in putting things in the ocean. There are all these subsea cables, right, that go between the continents.
And Microsoft has laid a few of their own.
We have. And I think that if you look at who does that today, it's largely technology companies and not telecoms. It's the enormous bandwidth is carried directly by these large data networks. So it's something we know how to do. And so in some sense, you can think of the data center as a bump in the cable.
Right.
Now, it's a bump that wants power. And so that power can come a couple ways. So for what we're doing today, that power is coming from shore. We're in the Orkney Islands of Scotland, which is a 100% renewable grid. In fact, actually exports renewable energy back to the mainland UK.
Right.
So that's what we're doing today. But if you think about the broader vision is this idea of co-location with offshore renewable energy. One of the reasons that we elected to do the second phase in Europe is today Europe is the leader in offshore renewable energy. 29 of the 30 largest offshore renewable wind farms are actually located in Europe. And if you look at where those wind farms typically go up, they're near major population centers.
Right.
So, for example, if you look at the estuary of outside of London, there are these four giant wind farms there. So if you co-locate with an offshore renewable energy farm today, wind, you're getting perhaps economies from similar infrastructure. Plus, you're getting close to your customers. One of the other things we like about this idea is because half the world's population lives with a couple hundred kilometers of the ocean, it's a way to sort of locate these things where they're close to customers without a big impact on society. We're not taking land. We're not taking power. And also, we're not taking water. One thing people may not realize is data centers, like modern office buildings, use water for the cooling systems.
Right.
And today, there are many parts of the world that are water stressed, right? That there's a lot of pressure on the water supply. And so we like this idea of a data center you can bring somewhere. It doesn't take land. It doesn't take electricity off what might be a stressed grid. It doesn't pull water competing against other users of fresh water. So we like this idea of this thing that is very renewable and very sustainable in its characteristics.
And I definitely want to spend time on the cooling side of this because I think it's probably one of the more complicated and unique aspects to this. But you were talking about offshore wind power being a great resource, but it's, you know, the wind doesn't blow everywhere all of the time. Can you count on that power 100%? What's the backup?
Well, so I think that's a really good question. And I think that's a big challenge in general with renewable energy is it's not reliable in that sense. It's not what we call base load.
Right.
Base load is something like it's coal or natural gas or nuclear that you know it's going to be running. We can power it on and off quickly when we want to in the case of, say, natural gas. And so today, wind obviously has issues. Solar has a very clear issue. There are other types of renewables that people are developing that maybe are better in some ways. So, for example, there's this notion of energy from tidal power.
Sure. And I did my research. The Orkney Islands has one of the largest wave power research projects going right now.
That's right. So the Orkney Islands, there's the European Marine Energy Center, which is where we're currently deployed, is the largest and most mature test venue in the world. And so today, the types of things people are testing there is offshore energy for tidal energy, wave energy, and then they're looking at other things like hydrogen storage. So the big game right now in renewables is how do we get to storage? And so California, for example, has mandated certain requirements for different companies in terms of storage in the grid. So what you'll start to see is wind farms, for example, whether they be on land or water, that maybe have storage associated with them
right, to
help you ride through those different downtimes. It's also, you can imagine, if you're a relatively small entity within a large wind farm, some of these wind farms, there's always some wind blowing.
Right.
Offshore wind is much more reliable than onshore wind is. So for sure, this question of power and reliability is important. Tide energy, in some sense, is really interesting to us because we know when the tides are going to happen. Combined with storage gives you this very clean and reliable flow through of renewable energy over a full cycle.
Yeah, tides are pretty consistent. Like, you're going to count on when things are going to move. Although wave action is wave action. Like, would name me a point in the ocean where there isn't waves moving.
It's actually interesting. You'll see times like, so for example, where we are in the Orkney Islands now, we're in the wave test site. And so in the winter, we expect the waves to be up to 10 meters.
Wow. That's so much energy.
Yeah. And so for people who don't know, that basically means from where we are, it could be 10 meters down or 10 meters up. Yeah. So it's like a 20 meter delta. It's enormous.
A 6-story building, you know.
Like, that's right.
It's unbelievable.
On the day that we deployed this, the waves were about half a meter.
Okay.
So and this is a site that has, you know, really powerful waves. So there is variability for that too. Although as you get further toward the poles of the planet, the wave energy becomes much more consistent.
Interesting.
So all of these things, you know, are options and different things. And we think it's wonderful as a company that people are deploying this. So Microsoft today, we are 100% carbon neutral in the sense that everything comes from renewable energy or carbon offsets. And we are a voracious consumer of renewables, looking always for more renewable energy for our data centers and more general use. So we really welcome all of these different things that people are doing in development.
Now, when it comes to energy storage in this equation, it makes total sense to me. I mean, I tend to look at stuff like the Tesla Powerwall. Do you want to have a little chamber of lithium ion batteries that can back up your data center for some portion of the day that can fill in those gaps?
Well, so today, if you look at a typical data center, what you'll find is there's a connection to the power grid.
Right.
And that's how we power it. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have backup generators, which will be diesel or natural gas, depending on where you are.
Right.
And then we have these rooms filled with batteries.
Yep.
And the purpose of those batteries is to keep the data center up for about a minute until those generators can come online in the case that the grid goes down.
Right.
But a data center can be quite large. Large data centers today are tens or even hundreds of megawatts.
Yeah, so that's a big battery.
It's a pretty big battery. And so realistically, I think we look toward the energy industry to sort of deal with this question of storage in terms of if I'm going to run for hours on batteries because the sun's not there or the wind's not that strong.
Yeah, for whatever reason the wind's not. I'm with you that the offshore winds are pretty reliable, but I got to think you need a little bit of bridging here and there. And could you do flywheels? Like, what other advantages of being down in that ocean environment that could give you power options?
Yes. So there are, you know, there's different types of energy. You know, there's other things like there's gyre power, but that's more limited, I think, in its applicability and some would argue in terms of safety.
Right. Gyre power meaning?
Gyre power means like the Florida Gulf Stream would be okay. What people would be familiar with in the United States. And basically what these are these large persistent currents in the ocean. And so the Florida Gulf Stream never goes below, and I'm going to have my memory a little wrong here, but I think never goes below about 1 meter per second.
Wow.
And ranges, we think, at between 1 and 1.5 meters per second. And it's consistent. So we know that runs constantly. It's refreshed by the winds. So that's another thing. You'll see that off typically, if you will, the eastern coasts of continents. Mm-hmm. So Florida is a good place, off Brazil, off Japan, for example, all have strong currents. So there's a variety of different types of these sources of energy out there that we could or choose or not choose to take advantage of.
And I've certainly seen big tidal turbines meant for tides that basically look like the same thing as a wind turbine, but just designed for water pushing through it. But again, they count on tides. This would be a continuous flow. It would turn out the same amount of power day in, day out, more or less.
That's right. And so that's another option. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in the United States has actually looked at that and has even thought about the size of lease blocks and how much power they'd allow people to pull out of any one of these different lease blocks. So there's been a fair amount of discussion about this sort of energy source as well.
Sure. Some of my favorite subjects in the world. Now, you've been talking about this purely as a data center, but is this ultimately a piece of the cloud? Would you be running chunks of Azure this way?
That would be the goal, is if we ever commercialize something like this, that yes, it would just be another data center as part of the cloud. And at some level, right, that's kind of the thing that for Microsoft as a large company is we've got all of these customers on, I mean, I only want to guess how many customers we have on Azure today.
There's a few.
There are a handful, for sure.
I'm one of them.
But we have today more than 100 data centers located in 40 or more countries, serving people in 140 countries. And our Azure revenues last year, I think, grew 93%.
Yeah.
So this is an enormous thing. And from at some point, right, this isn't kind of like, you know, something that you buy it, and if it kind of works okay most of the time, it's all right. At some sense, what the cloud is becoming really is a utility.
Right.
And so when you think of utilities, hopefully, depending on where you are, you think of them as a reliable thing that you can count on, and it's always delivering service as you expect and of high quality. And so that's what we strive to. And so when we think of Natick, Natick is, if you will, an example of Microsoft creatively reimagining what the cloud might be as we look toward the future and how demand and use changes and how we deliver this in ever more environmentally sustainable ways to customers. And we've got a bunch of things that we're doing, and Natick is an example of that sort of line of reasoning.
I really appreciate that. Ben, give me one moment here for this very important message. Underwater data centers, what will they think of next? For admins who live on land, we need to manage and secure our Windows PCs that are on-premises and always on the go. That's why you've got PolicyPack. PolicyPack increases your Windows security for your on-premises and roaming PCs. Remove local admin rights, manage all the security settings in your browsers in Java, and tame the Windows 10 start screen in Taskbar. Got machines out in the field without the latest group policy settings? Then use PolicyPack Cloud or your own MDM solution to deploy real group policy settings to those machines, only with PolicyPack. Get your free trial today and learn the secret weapon that hundreds of administrators use to manage and secure their Windows 7 and 10 desktops on-premises and out in the field. Head over to PolicyPack.com to get started today. PolicyPack, securing your standards. And we're back. It's Richard Campbell here on Run As Radio talking to Ben Cutler about Project Natick, undersea data centers. And I wanted to ask you a question, again, straight networker geek here. Latency. The fact that you could be right offshore of a city, is that a consideration that you would have low latency for that customer base?
That is absolutely a consideration. Very often data centers today are placed in regions that are somewhat remote.
Yeah, close to power plants typically.
Exactly. Close to power plants. Here in Washington State, we have one near one of the hydroelectric dams. We've got another one that's next to a wind farm in Texas. So that is absolutely a consideration. But we also like this idea of being close to customers, particularly as we look toward the future and we see more and more of these immersive interactive applications that we think will start to appear, as well as this whole notion of Internet of Things and the edge. So the idea that you can imagine factory floor has all of this machinery and wants to talk to the cloud and needs really low latency for things that it's doing. So we like this idea of low latency and being close to customers in order to enable that latency and the applications that we see coming along.
So power, data, I think we get that. I can't imagine that you're cooling these machines with salt water directly. So what's the cooling system look like?
The cooling system actually is remarkably simple. Literally what we do is we bring seawater in. We have what we call heat exchangers, which you can kind of think of the radiator in a traditional car with an internal combustion engine. And what happens is the servers pull air in from the front. And as that air flows to the server, it heats up. It hits that heat exchanger, which has this cold water from the ocean flowing through it.
Right.
It cools that air. And then out of that air whips back around ready to cool the servers again. And the other part of that cycle, of course, is that cold seawater comes in, gets warmed as it goes to the heat exchanger, and then is exhausted back out into the ocean. So it's actually remarkably simple compared to a land data center, which has all sorts of air handlers that may be open or closed depending on what the time of the year is.
Right.
We've got cooling towers, these complex evaporative cooling systems with air filters and all this other stuff. So we like this idea that it's this very simple system. And again, it's not using city water, so we're not competing with anybody for that resource.
So you've not modified the machines in any way. They're just regular air-breathing, rack-mounted servers. And you're just cooling the air with these radiators. Now, is it actually air? Would you bother with normal nitrox mix?
So the servers that we're running actually are servers that have been retired from a Microsoft data center. So yeah, it's completely compatible with anything that we do.
Right.
In normal data centers, there are standard 42U racks that we're using here. The atmosphere is different. We looked at land and we were wondering kind of what sort of things could we play with here and explore their contributions to failure. And there are four things in particular, the first of which is just people.
Yep.
The mere fact that you're doing maintenance, you're probably causing some other trouble. It's just reality, right? If I pull a board out, I had to electrically cycle it, I thermally cycled it, there's mechanical wear and tear. That's an effect. The second thing is we've known since at least the middle of the last century that temperature, high temperatures, and temperature variations both contribute to failure. And in fact, some studies show that a 10% Celsius difference in temperature is a factor of two in terms of lifetime.
Wow.
So we have no people. We are very cool. The data center as it's operating now, our ambient temperature, I think, is about 14 degrees Celsius.
Is that just mapped to the water around it?
That's right. It's relative to the, so the water is going to be the base temperature. So as that water temperature goes up or down, the temperature inside the data center will go up and down.
Right.
But one of the things that you find is that the oceans are remarkably consistent as you move around the world.
For sure.
So if you're off Florida, for example, and you're at 200 meters depth, the water is never warmer than 59 Fahrenheit or 15 C.
Right. And is that how deep you're going, is 200 meters?
Right now, we're at 36 meters. Okay. And the reason we're at 36 is because 40 is the limit at which humans can safely scuba dive without all sorts of complications.
Oh, right.
So we just wanted that flexibility in case at some point we need to send somebody down there to do something.
Right.
But from a practical standpoint, when we deploy, we're probably deeper than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe 100 meters, maybe more. So temperature variation. People. Another thing is this idea of corrosion. So when you have oxygen and you have water and you have metal, bad things happen.
Right.
And in data centers, that manifests, for example, in corrosion on connectors.
Yep.
So you have to go and reseat things. So we are running an oxygen-free environment with a low humidity.
Yeah, I would think like pure nitrogen and 0% humidity.
You would think that, and that would be bad.
Oh, really?
We thought that at first, too. And what you find is that, for example, on hard disks, the grease, if you will, or the lubrication on the bearings needs some moisture. If you take that moisture away, it will turn to powder.
Okay.
And your disk will be very, very unhappy.
No, they will cease being disks fairly quickly. They will just be lumps of metal.
It will be very unfortunate. So for that reason, we do have some moisture in there still.
Okay. But it's always, I mean, the main thing you want out of humidity is absolute consistency.
That's right. And then finally, in land data centers, there's always this question of contamination from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be gaseous, and you can get, you know, sulfur oxides and other unfortunate things. And it can be particulate matter that can get in, which we try really hard, of course, to keep that out. But some types of dust are electrostatic. Other types are metallic. Other types have corrosive acids in them. And so we're a completely sealed structure. So we think that these things I mentioned, so the people, the temperature and temperature variation, corrosion, and then the contaminants from outside, we've got those out. Now, maybe we have new issues that we don't understand yet.
Sure.
And of course, that's partly why we're doing this experiment.
Yeah, no, I think over time is the only way you're going to know. But you did eliminate the oxygen, so is it primarily nitrogen?
That's right.
Right. But and in enough humidity to keep things lubricated or to keep seals happy. And other than that, it's a closed system, you know. I guess the mechanical part then is the pumps moving the seawater through the heat exchangers.
That's right. So we're working with a company called Naval Group of France,
mm-hmm.
which builds, among other things, military nuclear subs. And as you might know, in nuclear submarines, there are pumps for the reactor, and people never, ever service those over the life of a submarine. So we have technologies that we're using here that are basically mature technologies.
Yeah, you don't need to invent this stuff. Other people have solved this already.
Exactly. And you had mentioned sort of the renewables up at EMEC. And so one of our appeals for why we're working with Naval Group here is that they have a subsidiary, which is actually the team we're working with, is called Naval Energies. And they do tidal energy and offshore wind and other things like that. So it's kind of a good match with Microsoft's aspirations for this very green and renewable future.
Sure. And I don't know that it's widely known, but certainly my experience talking with Azure folks and so forth is you typically just lease these racks from manufacturers for these Azure data centers for two or three years, and then they just take it away and dismantled and used for other purposes, and they're replaced. So do you see these pressure vessels just being lifted every couple of years and replaced routinely?
Well, it's an interesting question, which is how long do you hang on to servers?
Sure.
And I think if you look at how long we use servers today, that length of time, if you will, the cadence is slowing down. So we'll keep them more and more years. And this corresponds with this notion of the end of Moore's law.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if you think about your desktop computer, right, the clock rate hasn't really gone up very much in the last quite a few years now.
Yeah.
And so as this pace of innovation slows down, and mind you, there's always going to be some things like AI today is this hot thing where we really have to rev things very rapidly.
Yeah.
But for a lot of what we do, we expect we'll see less and less of that. And so we're kind of riding this trend of how do we get better value out of servers? How do we keep them longer? And in that sense, of course, it benefits not just us, but our customers. It makes us more competitive. Prices go down. Everybody benefits. And so if you think about what we're doing here in the water, we're exploring different types of environmental effects that will allow us to have greater reliability, which in essence is really a proxy for longevity. So how do I one day have a server that lasts the lifetime of the data center and I never change it? So all these concepts of the better environment, going to a manufacturing model for consistency, all of these things are really tied to that longer term question of what happens as Moore's law winds down right. and we enter this very different world.
But also as machines age, like as a guy who's, you know, built a bunch of data centers over the years, it's like bearings fail. Everything that spins is going to be your failure point, and that's fans and drives.
Yep, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we look to is how some of those technologies are evolving as well as we go forward.
Sure.
And I take, in some sense, as an example, other industries that have gone down this path in the past. So if you look at telephony, you go back to its roots. Mm-hmm. Every single call was manually connected by a human, right? Someone had to literally make that connection. And now we largely have this infrastructure that's in these buildings that people don't go there. They operate for years with little, if any, maintenance and kind of looking toward that kind of a future.
Right. But that's sort of ahead of where the machines are right now. You can already see advantages with offshore data centers or undersea data centers, even if the hardware doesn't need to be turned over on a regular basis.
Yep.
Shouldn't be that difficult to pull them up, have a replacement one in place, switch the cables, and put it back down again.
And that's how it would probably work. Is one of the features of this is that you have more flexibility. I don't have to build the giant building, so mm-hmm. I can kind of add and remove capacity as I choose to. And if I were going to turn over a whole subsea data center, I'd probably go down, and at the same time that I'm pulling the old things up, I'm putting the new things back down right. for efficiency.
Well, and I've had the good fortune to tour a bunch of the data centers of Azure in the eastern part of Washington and seen where they literally got a crane lifting one rack, one block of machines out, putting it on a train flatbed and putting another one down in its place.
Yep.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, the scale of this is just astonishing.
Yeah. Well, I laugh as I follow these first articles about Project Natick and you know, the regular news is talking about, well, the machines aren't serviceable. It's like, dude, we don't think that way in the cloud. You swap out whole racks. You don't worry about servicing individual machines.
Yeah, but we are very much on this sort of fail-in-place model. And
sure.
So in some sense, that's kind of the trade here is if I go to this model where I don't have people out there maintaining things, they will break. And so what does that failure rate look like compared to land against the trade of my lower costs for not having anybody there maintaining it? Mm-hmm. I'm not paying warranty costs, things like this. So that's part of the big question with this experiment.
Sure.
Is how does that all play out?
What other experiments are you doing there? Like, I would think increasing the atmospheric pressure in the chamber might be useful because you've got more density to move heat around with.
It is something that we've thought about. We've actually thought about things that go to very, very high pressures as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of our goals for now, though, was to try and stay with the existing supply chain. Because once you start changing the supply chain, you better really know what you're doing, because now you're talking substantial cost impact. And there are all sorts of things that will not be happy, say, if you doubled the atmospheric pressure.
Interesting. Like?
Well, hard disks, for example.
Right, because they're sealed and have their own internal pressures.
And that seal is only probably good to so much. Capacitors and other things that will have problem with pressures. Even cables have issues with pressure.
Interesting.
And so all of those things are surmountable. You can find, for example, subsea electronics that are under 100 atmospheres pressure or something
right.
crazy and work just fine. So you can substitute things, but it would require us to go and make some of those changes.
Well, and arguably even at 200 meters, the pressure vessel that protects the gear is not that big of a deal. Like, that's very known technology to be able to build something
right.
to maintain one atmosphere at 200 meters underwater.
And what we're doing is very modest compared to what goes on every day in you know, defense and oil and gas
sure.
and other industries like that.
But they also don't have budgets the same way we have budgets.
That's true. I mean, there's other things you can do besides pressure, right? Which we can look to atmospheres that are different gases.
Right.
So, for example, if I use something that's helium, for example, I'll get better thermal conduction. I'll get actually markedly better thermal conduction if I use hydrogen. But of course, that's got other issues associated with it.
It has its own price, without a doubt. See Hindenburg.
Yeah. So there are challenges. And also, what you're doing is enhancing the thermal conductivity from your electronics to the atmosphere, and
right.
then from the atmosphere into the heat exchanger. But
yes.
you have these other stages still. So in the overall mix, you don't necessarily get this as astonishing an effect as you'd think you would.
Yeah.
But all those things are definitely helpful. But right now, I think for where we are, we're pretty happy with what we're seeing in terms of our thermal efficiency.
But fundamentally, my experience is anything exposed to the ocean for long enough gets eaten. You've been talking about indefinite lifespan data centers, but I was sort of falling on this idea of, well, knowing they're going to turn over that rig every 2 to 5 years, they just got to make it durable enough to tolerate the ocean that long, then pull it up.
Yeah, so I think that when you look out at the water, you see this nice blue space. There's not a lot happening there. But in some sense, the ocean is basically, it's a tropical forest.
Mm-hmm.
And an example is when we string a new fiber optic cable between two continents, typically what will happen is a survey ship will go out and it will explore and define the route that you'll take. And then you have a limited period of time, which probably measured in weeks, before you actually go and lay the cable, because the terrain is going to change over time.
Sure, and you have to resurvey, without a doubt. I'm thinking more about the ability of mussels to find an inlet for water and grow there because it's got such a good flow.
So, right. So what you're referring to is what we call biofouling.
Right.
Which is to say things are growing.
Yes, especially in the ocean.
That's right. So if you have a house in the middle of the woods or even, frankly, in a city, you get vines and other things will eventually find their way to your structure.
Yep.
So we have the same thing in the ocean. And there are a number of factors that contribute to the growth. And those factors include sunlight, oxygen, nutrition, warmth, and stagnant water. And so some of those things we really can't control. They're going to be whatever they are. So whatever the oxygen is and the nutrition, we don't really have any control over. We have a little control over the lighting in the sense that the deeper you are, the less light you will have.
Sure.
And the colder it will be. What we do for this system is in part the water that flows through the system flows very rapidly. And so that makes it difficult for the biofouling to get initiated. So the way this works is the tiniest one-celled organisms find some way to latch on to something, and then the things that eat them are the next to arrive, and so on and so forth, until you end up with these mussels and other things that are big and you can actually physically see them.
Right.
And so we are using a technique that's quite common on submarines, which is I'm doing this direct seawater cooling. I flow through quickly. We have a couple other things that we don't disclose publicly that we think also help us with the biofouling. And that's part of the experimentation right now is to understand that.
Sure. And again, we're going to bump into sooner or later. You've got some patentable material here, some original thinking that's going to be really valuable. But, you know, I'm going to speculate off the top and think there's certain nanomaterial surfaces that are remarkably resistant to anything adhering to them. That would be just the sort of thing you'd probably want around an inlet.
There are all sorts of interesting technologies here. And one of the things that we observed on the first time that we did this is that these marine coatings, basically paint that go on ships and things.
Sure.
And you can take duct tape and put that duct tape on those surfaces and it will just fall off.
And everybody knows that duct tape sticks to everything, but anti-fouling paint is special.
We are not the first thing to go in the ocean.
Yeah.
People have kind of done this before.
Yeah, you listen to the experts that work in marine, you're going to get some good answers to a lot of these problems.
That's right. And I think what we do try and do is look at these things and ask which are the more environmentally sustainable approaches
Sure.
that we could do.
Well, and I think that's an interesting part of this. What are your comments towards environmental concerns around? Are you boiling the ocean with this technology? You know, and those sorts of things. What are the other, I've got to think you're considering all the environmental impacts here. This is such a focus of everything happening in Azure.
So at a high level, right, there's four things that we think about with Natick. So there's the sustainability aspects, there's cost, there's the rapid deployment, and there's close to customers.
Mm-hmm.
And the sustainability thing is foremost in everything we do. And so at a high level, you know, we're very interested in this question of, are we doing good or are we not? And so we kind of really start with put something on the whiteboard and work from there, eventually test something in the water and then measure it rigorously to really
Right.
understand what's going on before we go to the next step. So that if we ever do get to the point of commercialization, we really understand this thoroughly. On this question of, you know, boiling fish. So the first time that we did this off the coast of California, we had a different kind of a cooling system than we did this time. But for that system, what we measured is a few meters downstream of the vessel, water was like a few thousandths of a degree warmer.
Thousandths. Okay.
It's really tough.
I'm surprised you were able to measure that.
You can only measure it statistically. It's really tough. And basically, people know that water is this incredible heat capacity.
Sure.
And you see this, right? When you go and you try and boil water on your stove or in your microwave. You know, it's a tiny little bit of water and this like enormous flame or glow from the burners there, and it just takes a lot of time to heat up that water. If you looked at all the data centers in the world, and you put all of their energy directly into the oceans of the world, and you looked at the average temperature rise, it's like less than a millionth of a degree per year is what would be the impact.
Yes.
So for us, what's really important actually is this whole question of renewable versus conventional fuels.
Right.
Because global warming is the big issue. If you look at climate.gov, you can find basically in the last 50 years, 90% of all the heating of the planet has gone into the ocean. So an efficient green data center in the ocean is better than one that burns more energy that's on land, because the atmosphere and oceans are a combined system.
Sure.
So that's really what matters to us. So for what we're doing right now, so again, we'll be looking to understand exactly what the impact is. We also look to positive things we can do. And so one of the things that we're interested in exploring down, we're not doing it this time, maybe next time we'll do it, is this notion of data centers in the ocean as artificial reefs.
Interesting.
As a way that, you know, potentially we can be a positive contribution to helping the local ecosystem.
The same way they've been sinking old ships and other pieces to give places for reefs to take a hold on.
That's right. And there's a couple ways that might happen. One of which is the data center itself might be that artificial reef, or just in the process of putting it down, maybe we'd put other structures down with us that help promote life.
That's interesting. So what comes next for Project Natick? Obviously, you've got the test cycle going in the Orkneys. You're going to learn from that. But do you have a picture of the next phase?
Well, I think we are really pretty much, we are thinking about what we might do next. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that would be something that's at larger scale and maybe go to some new location for Microsoft where we can actually help customers.
Right.
But really right now, we just got this thing in the water. And so we're, you know, putting it through its paces, and people are using it to develop different types of code. For example, one of the things we have got cameras on this thing. So we have a group here called AI for Earth. And this is a part of the company that, among other things, gives out grants to people who are using AI to help the environment. And so there, for example, looking at what's going by the data center, so over time we can kind of characterize the sea life and how that changes, if at all, while we're there in the water. So we've got a bunch of different things that we're doing that will help us both understand how we behave in this environment, how the servers are in this kind of environment, mm-hmm. as well as any effects that we're having on the sea life around us.
Fantastic. Ben, such a pleasure to talk to you. It's such an interesting project in terms of how we're going to modernize these worldwide data centers to be a constructive force for the planet, and also get all the compute we actually want.
We are doing our best to serve our customers and good to the environment at the same time. Richard, thank you very much for taking the time to talk.
Oh, my pleasure. Hope to talk to you again.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.